That lines, China says it firmly opposes new U.S. sanctions against several of its officials and companies over alleged misdeeds in the South China Sea. Taliban militants kill at least a dozen Afghan security forces in attacks on checkpoints in northern Kunduz province. And at least 37 people are killed, hundreds more injured after a powerful 6.2 magnitude earthquake struck Indonesia's Sulawesi Island. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half hour, China has reiterated its firm opposition to new U.S. sanctions on Chinese officials and companies.
The measures introduced by President Trump once again showed the world what unilateralism is, what is double standards, and what is bullying. China will take necessary measures to resolutely safeguard the legitimate rights and interests of Chinese enterprises and resolutely support Chinese enterprises in safeguarding their rights and interests in accordance with the law.
The Foreign Ministry spokesman also accused U.S. President Donald Trump of generalizing the concept of national security, abusing national power, and repeatedly suppressing Chinese companies for no reason. On Thursday, the Trump administration imposed an investment ban on 9 more Chinese firms for alleged misdeeds in the South China Sea. The blacklisted firms with alleged ties to the Chinese military include plane maker Comac and phone maker Xiaomi Corporation. The sanctions are the latest in a series of measures by Trump against China amid escalating tensions between the two sides. Russia says it's withdrawing from the Open Skies Treaty, citing lack of progress on upholding it after the United States last year left the accord. The Russian Foreign Ministry says it's beginning domestic procedures for the withdrawal from the pact, which allows unarmed surveillance flights over member countries. Russia's raised concerns that Washington still could get access to overflight intelligence gathered by allies who remain in the treaty. The U.S. left the accord in November, accusing Moscow of violating it. The Russian Foreign Ministry has said the U.S. Had used a fictitious pretext for its withdrawal, which disturbed the balance of interests of the participating states. Moscow's last major nuclear arms pact with Washington is also set to expire next month, just days after the inauguration of Joe Biden as the next U.S. president. Afghan officials say overnight Taliban attacks in northern Kunduz province have left at least a dozen security personnel dead and many others wounded. The officials say militants launched simultaneous raids on 2 checkpoints in Kunduz. They've been quoted as saying that a civilian was also killed in one attack. The Taliban have not commented on the raids, but the militant group has carried out similar attacks against security forces in the province in the past. The Taliban also briefly took control of Kunduz city twice. In recent years, violence has surged across Afghanistan. In recent weeks, despite ongoing talks between the Taliban and the Afghan government in Doha in an effort to find a lasting peace to the country. Well, it was November 2020 when the U.S. Acting Defense Secretary Chris Miller announced that the country would slash its troop levels to 2,500 in both Iraq and Afghanistan in the following year. The withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan has already been welcomed by top Afghan officials. They say the absence of foreign troops will not adversely affect the Afghan military. We have more in this report.
On October 7, 2001, the U.S. and British forces attacked Afghanistan. Later in November that year, there were 1,300 American troops in the country. They were increased to 100,000 in 2010. Anti-U.S. sentiments had increased among Afghans, mainly due to its failures in protecting civilians as well as in uprooting terrorism and narcotics production.
The Afghan government says international assistance to Afghan army will continue in 2021 amid the U.S. withdrawal and controversial peace talks between Kabul and the Taliban. However, some top officials here say Kabul is militarily capable of coping with any emergency situation.
Addressing a recent meeting in the Afghan Defense Ministry, President Ghani emphasized that the National Army is the symbol of the country's pride and that nothing will stop it from serving the country and the nation despite a possible reduction of foreign support.
I have repeatedly said, and I'm saying now, that we will not build roads in case of emergency situations, but the Afghan Army will be fully active under any circumstances.
Top military officials in Kabul believe the withdrawal of foreign troops from Afghanistan will not create an opportunity for terrorists to win the war.
The potential withdrawal of foreign forces is not a matter of concern for us because 96% of operations are being conducted independently by our own forces. We receive aerial support from our international allies for the remaining 4%. It means that we are not concerned about the withdrawal of foreign forces.
Adding to the uncertainty surrounding the withdrawal of American forces from Afghanistan, U.S. President-elect Joe Biden will take office on January 20th as a step to announce the official stance of his administration on U.S. Taliban deal that was inked back in February 2020. As official statistics show, America's longest war in Afghanistan has so far claimed the lives of over 4,000 U.S. troops, tens of thousands of Afghan military forces, and over 50,000 civilians. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
The U.S. has rejected a plea by U.N. officials to reverse the decision to declare Yemen's Ansar La movement a terrorist group. U.S. Deputy Ambassador to the U.N. said the designation would help move forward the political process to settle the Yemen conflict. Richard Mills was addressing a U.N. Security Council briefing that saw fierce criticism of the U.S. decision. On Sunday, Washington blacklisted the Ansar La movement, which controls northern Yemen. U.N. officials have opposed the designation, citing humanitarian impact and dire consequences for the peace process in Yemen.
I am extremely concerned about the impact of the decision from the United States to designate Ansar Allah as a foreign terrorist organization. We fear, in my mission, that there will be inevitably a chilling effect on my efforts to bring the parties together.
We are struggling now without the designation. With the designation, it's going to be catastrophic. It literally is going to be a death sentence to hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of innocent people in Yemen.
UN Humanitarian Chief Mark Lowcock also urged Washington to reverse its decision. He said Ansar Allah's designation could cause a famine not seen in the past four decades. The European Union also criticized the U.S., saying the designation could hinder aid deliveries to Yemen. The country has been devastated by the Saudi-led war that began in 2015. The UN has described Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Ansar Allah and its allied army units are fighting Riyadh that is backed by Washington. International lawyer Edward Corrigan says that the U.S.'s decision to blacklist Ansar Allah would be another disaster for millions of people in Yemen.
A lot of commentators look at the Hutus, and they're based in Sana'a, as the real government, and then the Saudis and UAE and their allies are in the south, with their fracture too. The Saudis support one faction, the UAE supports another faction. There is Al-Qaeda elements. There are, people that are tied with the Yemeni government, but that's a confusing mess. But this is clearly a disaster to say that they're a terrorist group and then to impose all sorts of sanctions. The European Union, European countries are opposed to this. You also have the United Nations speaking out strongly against it.
Right.
And again, it's the poor people of Yemen. They're going to suffer the consequences. They're going to be starved into submission. The only tool the Trump administration has is a sledgehammer, and they just want to smash their opponents.
News review, where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has launched major military exercises in the central desert of the country. The first stage of the maneuvers kicked off with firing surface-to-surface ballistic missiles and operating bomber drones. The missiles, equipped with detachable warheads, are guided from outer space and are able to penetrate into the enemy's missile shield. The exercises have been held in the presence of IRGC Commander-in-Chief Major General Hossein Salami and other senior military officials. Salami hailed the drills as successful, adding that using new technology in controlling and directing missiles and drones was one of the main features of the maneuvers. Head of IRGC's Aerospace Division, Amirali Hajizadeh, also said that Iran test-fired a new generation of ballistic missiles during Friday's exercises. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have journalist and commentator Mostafa Khoshchesh joining us from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Also, we have author and commentator Mr. John White joining us from Edinburgh. Mr. White, I'm going to start off with you. How do you view the importance and the significance of these drills?
Well, certainly they're necessary given the multiple threats that Iran is faced with from hostile powers in the region, primarily Israel and Saudi Arabia, and also surrounded by many US bases within striking distance. The US Fifth Fleet is headquartered at Bahrain and regularly patrols the Persian Gulf. But the most important reason why these exercises are so necessary now is because of the unhinged character of Donald Trump. With a week to go before his time in office ends, he recently deployed B-52 bombers to the region, which is a serious provocation. So it's certainly timely that Iran conducts these exercises to prove that its military is up to the task of any threats it may face. It's modernized, and it keeps up a strong deterrence.
Mr. Khoshchesh in Tehran, talk to us about these drills and the significance of these exercises. We know that a new generation of missiles were also tested during today's exercises and drills.
Thanks for having me. Well, it's true, Tehran has been exposed to many threats since the Islamic Revolution. It came under attack by Saddam Hussein, which was supported by 37 nations directly and more than 80 nations indirectly, while Tehran was under sanctions, so it started its arms development program in the 1980s. And now it has developed a very robust asymmetrical power and warfare in, with regard to its missile power that has deterred enemies. So it's very much important to deter the United States and Israeli threats to Iran. And also, it's very much important to deter Donald Trump's threat to Tehran. That's very important. But these are the points that my colleague said, and I need to add up more angles to that. You know that the United States maximum pressure policy, which will be pursued, of course, by President-elect Joe Biden, is aimed at containing Iran's power components in the region, its nuclear industry, as well as its missile industry. So these drills are a message to Biden that Tehran has no intention, not at all whatsoever, to go for compromise or concession to limit or contain its missile program, especially its ballistic missile power. Also, what needs to be understood much more in strategic context is that the United States has long been pursuing a policy of containment through threats, opposing credible military threats, but not necessarily any kind of action, alongside sanctions in order to change the perception of Iranian public and elected officials, the ones that they elect to office and then change their calculations, push them through talks in order not to resolve the conflict, but to give concessions the way they desire. And that's what happened with regard to the JCPOA, as we all witnessed very, very clearly. So they mean to go for the same path under Joe Biden. This strategy started under Obama, and it was continued despite all allegations and views and cries about Donald Trump. He never did anything beyond this containment strategy. So it's very much important to note that when it comes to military threats by the United States and Israel, what is for real is augmented. The picture is important. The perception is important. So it doesn't entail any kind of action necessarily. They mean to just change the perception in Tehran and among the public and officials and to change the calculations to push them to talks to receive merits from and concessions from Tehran. So they do propaganda 7-8 times more than the reality, what is on the ground, and they try to change the calculations in Tehran. Last year, in triple incidents in the Persian Gulf with regard to the British ship, as well as the global hawk that Iran shut down, as well as the Iranian missile strike on Ain al-Assad, we all saw that there was no action on the part of the United States. So it's just threats for the sake of changing calculations. The image and the propaganda that they do is very important, and the effect and impact of this propaganda and image, media image, that they try to portray among Iranian officials and people is very, very much important. Now, these drills are sending this message that no matter what you do, and irrespective, and unlike, despite all your propaganda, Iran is very much resolved to stand strong with regard to its missile program, and threats are hollow, and Tehran would not budge. This is very important because Iran tested new technology, and in the words of Iranian top commander, Hajizadeh, aerospace commander, he said that Iran generated a new power today through a combination of new ballistic missiles that resemble somehow the multiple re-entry vehicles, somehow, alongside different types of drones.
Right. Mr. White, I'm going to come back to you now. Please, if you have anything to add to the comments made by our guest, Antaron, also I'd like you to elaborate on another issue, the fact that despite the sanctions, the technology that was put on display, how important is it that all of this was indigenous and domestically manufactured in Iran?
Well, this is a wonderfully symbolic statement made by the Iranians with regard to the high-tech nature of their capability now with regards to their missile stocks. The Americans will be worried. The Israelis will certainly be worried, as will the Saudis, because Iran has proved that despite the attempts, as my colleague rightfully and eloquently explained, to exert maximum pressure vis-a-vis sanctions, Iran still has the will, the capability, and the cohesiveness to develop this kind of missile technology. So I think that Western intelligence agencies will be very surprised at what the Iranians have unveiled. And every military exercise is part of a conversation taking place between adversaries. And Iran clearly, due to its inability to trust the words of an American president when it comes to diplomatic agreements vis-a-vis the Iran nuclear deal, understands that peace for Iran in the region can only come through strength. This is making a strong statement. The Iranians are rightfully angry at the way that Trump ripped up the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA, and they will be expecting Joe Biden to come and with an apologetic stance to re-enter and resurrect that deal, which was one of Obama's few foreign policy successes and one of the few successes of US diplomacy since the demise of the Soviet Union. So Joe Biden has a lot to prove, and he has a lot to prove to the Iranians. The Iranians have nothing to prove to him. They've done nothing wrong. It's all about Joe Biden and the approach he takes to Iran and he takes to Israel and the Palestinians, which is still the burning question at the heart of that region's instability and ongoing strife.
Right. Thanks a lot, author and commentator John White, joining us from Edinburgh. Also, thanks to journalist and commentator Mostafa Khoshchesh, joining us from the Iranian capital, Tehran. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of our news review. But do stay tuned. There's plenty more to come here on. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Eight-year holy defense.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we have said several times that the Iraqi dictator Saddam's main goal of initiating the eight-year war and invading Iran was to overthrow the Islamic Republic system. He pursued other goals too, but he and his masters in Washington, Moscow, Tel Aviv, and Europe didn't reach any of their goals. As a reminder, we discussed the various characteristics of besieged volunteer forces which led to the victory of the Islamic Republic of Iran in the Holy Defense. Today we are going to continue the discussion. The operation for breaking the siege of Abadan, liberation of Khorramshahr, crossing the turbulent Arvand River in Valfajr 8 operation, and the consequent of Fav Peninsula were among the surprise operations that took place with the bravery of young Basiji forces. The long years of the war set the ground for Imam Khomeini to explicate and put into practice of the Islamic views on defense. Therefore, the Iranian nation became familiar with the culture of jihad and martyrdom. As a result, the Ba'athist enemy failed in achieving any of its goals of the war. During the eight-year war, the Iranian combatants launched nearly 100 small and great operations. The operational upper hand was in Iran's authority for approximately 6.5 years. Imam Khomeini said on this, "We are boastful that in this long and unequal battle, we have achieved victory only with reliance on the weapon of faith, trust in great God, the prayer of Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance, self-confidence, and the endeavor of the brave men and women on the war front. And we thank God that we are not indebted to any power, country, or superpower. And our experienced people, with trust in God and seeking His help, have overcome many problems alone in terms of designing, operation, mobilization, and training of forces to the need for arms. And in addition to gaining miraculous successes in the scenes of defense of the Islamic country, pulling out the invaders from thousands of kilometers, we have achieved spectacular industrial developments such as launching of factories and changing the production lines, manufacturing and invention of scores of advanced and modern military devices, and that without the presence of any advisor or foreign helper. The eight-year imposed war caused myriads of problems for the Iranian people and the government. This caused the hidden talents of the young generation to flourish in various fields. Thus, with reliance on people's capabilities, Iran stood firmly against the enemies of humanity. Gradually, the Iranian nation turned into the producer of sophisticated equipment and arms. The war caused the military and defense industry to develop in the country, especially in the field of missile technology. In some period in the war, only half of Iran's military industry was active. Yet, Iran managed to administer the needs of the battlefield despite cruel sanctions that had been imposed by big powers, especially the great Satan, the US. With the relentless efforts of great and selfless martyrs like Hassan Shafizadeh and Hassan Tehrani Moghaddam, the ammunition for the artillery were gradually made, and this led to greater breakthroughs in the field of missile industry. Little by little, the Islamic Republic succeeded to indigenize Scud B, Tav missiles, and make native missiles like Shahab 2 with 1,000 kilometers range. Then Iran entered other areas of defense technology and made coast-to-sea missiles. Moreover,
the Islamic Republic succeeded to produce the fuselage of some helicopters like Cobra and 313 transportation aircraft. In later phases, Iran gained the know-how for manufacturing various parts of warplanes. Today, Iran is self-sufficient in over 90% of its military needs and defense industry, and is even able to export many items. Among the valuable achievements of the Holy Defense were the experiences that Iran gained in management, particularly in the field of designing, guidance, and execution of different operations. As the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, put it, the 8-year war has been an unending treasury. The war turned young combatants into great experienced generals, whose military designs dumbfounded top brasses in the world. Some of those brave youths attained martyrdom, while others lived to transfer their precious experiences to the next generations. No doubt, the most prominent feature of the Holy Defense was the unmatched leadership of Imam Khomeini as the commander-in-chief of the war. This was the greatest strong point of Iran. The Iranian people loved him deep in heart and were ready to sacrifice their life for him and his cause. The Imam was indeed the fulcrum of the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Republic. As it has been said in earlier episodes of this series, Imam Khomeini said in the beginning of the war that the war was a bounty for us. The war acted as an engine to awaken the dormant talents of the Iranian nation and turn it into an independent power. The Imam strongly believed in the Iranian people, and the people believed in his honesty, prudence, foresight, and wisdom. As Imam Khomeini was not afraid of anyone, he inspired this spirit among the Iranian people too. So, they believed in their capacities and made their utmost effort to turn the potentials into practice. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, gave the people the motive to pursue lofty goals without fearing the ruling powers. Dear listeners, next time you will hear the final episode of this series. Pilgrimage again.
The years of war in Syria were difficult years, a time when Syria was the source of bad news. Before the war, Syria was so peaceful that it seemed it was solely created for pilgrims to visit it and seek tranquility, a place of pilgrimage for Muslims and Christians alike. But war killed and destroyed so much of Syria that perhaps it has killed the memories of the past too, the memories held in the minds of those who had seen Syria before the war. War has ended in many Syrian cities, and this means that pilgrims can once more travel to Syria for pilgrimage. With this hope that pilgrims will once again set foot in this land, we will visit the different pilgrimage sites in Syria and see how they have survived the war. Aleppo is Syria's largest and most populated city. It is also among the oldest cities in the world that has linked the East to the West for many centuries. Aleppo is not only a city for Muslims, many Christians also live in this city. In fact, one of Aleppo's tourist attractions is the many beautiful churches in the city. Historically, Aleppo has been famous for its bustling bazaars, its textile industry, its seminaries and universities, and the Aleppo Citadel. These are all what makes Aleppo important and special. And perhaps due to its importance, terrorists tried relentlessly to fully occupy the city during the war, but they were never successful. This enduring war has left Aleppo with scars. In the city, one can find prosperous and bustling neighborhoods next to neighborhoods that have been fully destroyed. For Muslims, especially Shia Muslims, Aleppo is home to two important sites, and it was always visited whenever Muslims travel to the city, Mashhad al-Hussein and Mashhad al-Muhsin. It is said that when the Karbala caravan enters Syria from Iraq, it stayed near a church for one night. A holy father from the church noticed that there is a light shining up to the sky from Imam Hussein's decapitated head. That is why, by paying a hefty sum of money to the soldiers, he managed to borrow the Imam's head for a night. The holy father baptizes it and places it on an altar. This altar is now a pilgrimage site. The current building was built around Mashhad al-Hussein. Its architecture resembles that of old churches in the area. Mashhad al-Muhsin is also related to the events of Ashura. It is said that Imam Hussein's wife was pregnant, but the baby was lost after the incident of Ashura. The baby was named Muhsin and was buried in the place that later became known as Mashhad al-Muhsin. These two pilgrimage sites only stand 300 meters apart, but during the war in Aleppo, it was the border between the terrorists and the resistance. The terrorists managed to invade and occupy Mashhad al-Muhsin, but they were never able to set foot in Mashhad al-Hussein, despite all their efforts. Yet this pilgrimage site was severely destroyed by the war. After the war, Shia Muslims reconstructed the site, and now both pilgrimage sites are ready for pilgrims to arrive.
Assalamu alaikum.
In Aleppo, there is a tomb that is said to belong to Zechariah, which is located in the Great Mosque of Aleppo. This mosque was originally constructed in the first century of the Islamic calendar. During the war, the Great Mosque of Aleppo was occupied by terrorist forces, and that is how this historic monument was transformed into this ruin. With the liberation of Aleppo, the restoration of the Great Mosque of Aleppo started. This is why all the original pieces of stone were carefully recovered and meticulously recorded so that they can be put in place during the restoration project. Currently, this mosque is not open to visitors or pilgrims. But after its restoration, this mosque and the tomb will certainly be a destination for pilgrims visiting Aleppo. To see the rest of Syria's pilgrimage sites, one must travel from Aleppo towards Damascus. The first place you will come across is Adra. The tomb of Hujr ibn Adi is located in Adra. Hujr was a close companion of Prophet Muhammad and Imam Ali. He never agreed to swear allegiance to Muawiyah and continuously disclosed his corruption. And that is why Muawiyah ordered him to be killed. When Hujr was apprehended, he was given the chance to use profanity against Imam Ali in order to live, but he did not agree. Hujr, along with his son and a number of his companions, were martyred in the 51st year of the Islamic calendar. In August 2013, terrorists occupied the region and entered the mosque where the tomb of Hujr was located. They destroyed the building and desecrated the grave and claimed to have removed the corpse from its original resting place. But after the liberation of Adra, it became evident that the terrorists had only dug less than a meter deep, and since the body was buried much deeper, the terrorists never actually managed to reach it. This site was later restored by Iraqi defenders of the shrine and other Shia Muslims. This site is ready for pilgrims to visit it. On the outskirts of Damascus lies the Mosque of the Prophet Abel. It is located 45 kilometers from the capital city of Syria. This site has always attracted pilgrims to Syria. After visiting Adra and the tomb of Hujr, the caravans of pilgrims reached Damascus. Historians claim that the city of Damascus dates back to 3000 BC. It is the oldest city in the world that still stands, and people are still living in it. Damascus is just as sacred to Christians and Jews as it is to Muslims. But for Shia Muslims, Damascus is home to a few sacred sites, and one of them is the Bab el-Saghir Cemetery. It is a large cemetery in the center of Damascus that is the burial site for a number of the Prophet's companions and children of the 12 Imams. The most important of which is the tomb of Kulsum, the daughter of Imam Ali and Hazrat Zahra. Close by is the tomb of Sakina, the daughter of Imam Hussein. These two tombs are located in one chamber, and pilgrims can easily visit both. It is believed that Bab el-Saghir Cemetery is also the burial grounds of Abdullah, the son of Imam Sadiq Fatima Sughra, one of Imam Hussein's daughters, and Abdullah, the son of Imam Sajjad. The graves of nine of the Prophet's companions are also located in this cemetery, the most notable of which is Bilal, the first muazzin of Islam. Another companion of the Prophet is Abdullah Ja'far Tayyar, the husband of Lady Zainab. His tomb is adjacent to that of Bilal's. According to some historical documents, three of the Prophet's wives, Salama, Habiba, and Hafsa, are also buried in the cemetery. Faiza and Asma, Hazrat Zainab's maids, are also buried here too. Next to Bab el-Saghir Cemetery is a holy place which is believed to be the burial site for the heads of 16 martyrs of Karbala. They belong to Hazrat Abbas and his brothers, Ali Akbar, Imam Hussein's son, Abdullah and Qasim, the sons of Imam Hassan, Habib ibn Mazahir and Hur are among the 16 heads that have been buried here. This area is separated from the cemetery, and inside the shrine, there are 16 turbans that signify the 16 heads. There are other historical narratives that say that there are only three heads belonging to Hazrat Abbas, Ali Akbar, and Habib ibn Mazahir buried here. Bab el-Saghir Cemetery was threatened many times by the terrorists, but with the resistance of the people and the army, it was never occupied. This cemetery remains as one of the major pilgrimage sites of Damascus. The Umayyad Mosque, also known as the Great Mosque of Damascus, is one of the main tourist attractions of Damascus. Parts of this mosque date back 1,400 years. The mosque was built on the site of a Christian basilica, which was the burial ground of John the Baptist. With the construction of the mosque, the burial site of John the Baptist was included inside the building, and Shia Muslims, Sunni Muslims, and Christian pilgrims visited. In the Umayyad Mosque, there are four rectangular halls. One of them is dedicated to Imam Ali, but among Shias, it is known as Ra's al-Hussein. When the Karbala caravan reached Damascus with all of the decapitated heads of the martyrs and the family of the martyrs as captives, they entered the Umayyad Mosque where Yazid was. It is said that the holy head of Imam Hussein was placed where the shrine stands today, known as Ra's al-Hussein. Next to it is a prayer rug and mihrab encased in a glass cubicle, which marks the place where Ali ibn Hussein Zain al-Abidin used to pray while imprisoned in the castle after the Battle of Karbala. The Sayyida Ruqayya Mosque. This mosque is found a short distance from the Umayyad Mosque and contains the grave of Ruqayya, the young daughter of Imam Hussein. After enduring the Battle of Karbala and the torturous journey to Damascus that followed it, Ruqayya reached the Umayyad Mosque. As she could not bear any longer, one night the orphaned three-year-old dreamed of her father and woke up and cried relentlessly. She cried so hard that the soldiers informed Yazid. He ordered the guards to show her the decapitated head of her father Imam to make her quiet. And Yazid was right. The three-year-old Ruqayya was silenced forever. This tragic and moving incident has captivated the hearts of not just Shia pilgrims, but Sunnis and Christians alike. From the very first days of war on Syria, the occupation of Damascus was the terrorists' main agenda. That is why many of the suburbs on the outskirts of the city were occupied or were ceaselessly targeted by the terrorist rockets. One of these suburbs was Daraya, which the terrorists managed to occupy. This suburb was considered as a very strategic base for them, as it was located only 5 kilometers from Damascus. It took 5 years of war to liberate Daraya. It is not too hard to guess what the terrorists did to Hazrat Sakina's shrine while they occupied the area.
the shrine of Sakina, the daughter of Imam Ali, was completely destroyed when Daraya was occupied by the terrorists. The occupation has razed Daraya to the ground. The town is in ruins, and the Syrian army has not yet allowed it to be open to the public to enter. And devoted Shias are awaiting the time when the Syrian government reopens the gates of Daraya and they can rebuild the shrine. For sure, the main reason pilgrims travel to Syria is to visit the shrine of Hazrat Zainab. The terrorists almost reached it. They only had 100 meters to go, but they never managed to occupy it because of the resistance forces blocked them. The resistance forces included Syrian Sunni Muslims and Shia Muslims from Syria, Lebanon, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iran, and Iraq. The Iraqi resistance forces could not bear to see the shrine empty of pilgrims, so they brought in their family members from Iraq for pilgrimage during those difficult days. And thus, the shrine of Hazrat Zainab became the central hub for the resistance forces. And the valor of the resistance in defending the shrine inspired resistance forces across Syria. Now pilgrims can visit the shrine of Hazrat Zainab in absolute safety and security.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.